Funds for the California Report are provided by Chevron, investing in renewables, strengthening communities, and creating jobs. More information available at chevron.com. The California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. And URS Corporation, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical services to public agencies and private companies. urscorp.com.
This is a special edition of the California Report. Coming up, a decade after the 9/11 attacks, the lasting impact here on law enforcement, military families, and Muslim communities. Plus, a musical reflection on 9/11 from composer Steve Reich, performed by the Kronos Quartet.
When I walked out on the stage, I knew, I could feel that there were people in that room that had lost loved ones.
I'm Scott Schaefer. The September 11th attacks happened thousands of miles from here, but the weapons were four commercial airplanes bound for California. On our show today, we'll hear some of the ways we're still feeling the impact of that horrible day a decade later. We begin in Los Angeles, where three of those four planes were heading September 11th. As the California Report's L.A. Bureau Chief Chrissy Clark reports, the attacks helped transform the city's police department.
Michael Downing is in charge of the Los Angeles Police Department's Counterterrorism Bureau, a bureau that, 10 years ago, did not even exist.
Pre-9/11, we had 35 people working anti-terrorism intelligence, and now we are 700-plus with a tactical arm, an investigative arm, and an intelligence arm.
All that adds up to the second-largest counterterrorism program in the nation after New York. Downing's bureau has a roughly $50 million budget, fueled by federal homeland security grants and local taxes. Much of the work happens on the 10th floor of police headquarters in downtown L.A., behind this locked door. Beige carpets, cubicles. At first, it looks kind of like an insurance office, but then you notice the computers connected to surveillance tools and cyber hunting software, and the special area with blocked windows and sealed phone lines that you need a 6-month security clearance to enter.
Where we can talk about top secret information with the Pentagon, the White House, the FBI office, etc.
Why does LA need all this? The city's got plenty of targets. LAX, the nation's busiest port, iconic Hollywood. The 9/11 Commission found LA's tallest building on an early list of hijacker targets. Until 9/11, it was the FBI or the CIA who mostly worried about that stuff. But Downing says local police are in a good position to help.
They're out there 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. They know the landscape. They know the names of people. They understand social networks. They understand criminal enterprises. And now they're beginning to understand the nature of the threat of terrorism.
But defining the nature of a terrorist threat, that gets tricky. And the LAPD's approach has raised a lot of civil liberties questions across the city.
So I try to paint really aggressively, and especially in the beginning, really scrub that color on there.
A few weeks ago, an artist named Alex Schaefer set up his easel on a street corner in front of a Chase Bank to do an oil painting of it. A mostly realistic portrait, with one twist.
The roof line is just billowing smoke and flames.
Right over the Chase logo.
Right over the Chase logo, yeah.
It was part of a series, he says, about the role banks have played in the global economic collapse. But the two Los Angeles police officers who approached him that day saw it differently. One ran his ID. The other questioned him.
He said, well, you know, you could be a terrorist. Do you hate the banks? I said, I don't hate the banks. Do you intend to do this to the banks? And of course, I was like, no.
They wrote up a report. 3 weeks later, two plainclothes officers from the LAPD knocked on his door and asked more questions. It's the kind of run-in that concerns Peter Biebring. He's an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union in L.A. He says we need to ask ourselves
whether we're really pursuing leads that are useful or whether we're discouraging constitutionally protected conduct.
Bibrin says as the LAPD has gotten deeper into the counterterrorism business, more and more things qualify as suspicious activity in the police handbook. In fact, there's a 48-point checklist that police are now required to consult when they make a routine stop. Some of the activities are obvious, like attempts to acquire illegal explosives. But Bibrin says others are too vague.
Takes pictures or video footage with no apparent aesthetic value, draws diagrams, or takes notes. The idea that officers are instructed to report non-criminal incidents is a real shift from the mission of law enforcement as we thought about it before September 11th.
Chief Michael Downing of the LAPD Counterterrorism Bureau says he takes these concerns seriously and that intelligence gathering procedures get yearly audits by a citizen commission. He also says intelligence is just one part of how LA police fight terrorism.
We spend just as much time on the motivational aspect and outreach engagement to communities to understand what their grievances are, to teach them how to use government, to really build trust and friendships in these communities.
Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah.
One place where the LAPD has done intense outreach is mosques like this one. The Islamic Center of Southern California. Hundreds of Angelenos come here to pray every Friday. The center's director of religious affairs is Jihad Turk. Yes, Jihad. He jokes that the way people respond to his first name says a lot about the problem facing American Muslims.
People before 9/11 just thought it was a weird Mexican name. Now they think it means holy war. It really means the struggle to do the right thing. There is a sensitivity in our community. Most Americans know very little about Islam and Muslims. And so we feel like we as, you know, Muslim Americans are under suspicion just by default of being American Muslims.
The LAPD's counterterrorism programs haven't always helped matters. A few years ago, Chief Downing announced plans to map Muslim communities in L.A. and caused an uproar. He then quickly called the plan off. But while there have been stumbles, through them, Jihad Turk has actually become a close advisor to Chief Downing. Early on, he gave the chief this advice.
Come to us through the front door. You'll be well received. But we ask not to come in the window or the back door because then it leads to suspicion and lack of trust.
It's a bit of a tightrope walk. Building trust at a mosque after Friday prayers while conducting covert surveillance on suspicious activities across town. And it's hard to measure the tangible results from either approach. Chief Downing estimates his bureau has disrupted a couple dozen operations related to financing, recruiting, or planning an act of terror. Of course, since 9/11, success sometimes involves what hasn't happened. For the California Report, I'm Chrissy Clark in Los Angeles.
Two of the 9/11 hijackers lived for a time in San Diego. As a result, the Muslim community there has endured suspicion from neighbors and more scrutiny from law enforcement. As Amitha Sharma from KPBS reports, distrust still lingers on both sides, but efforts are also underway to diminish it.
It was here in a modest working-class neighborhood in Claremont where two of the September 11th hijackers lived at the Parkwood Apartments. The apartments are now condos with picture book white-trimmed facades. But for many longtime residents, the memory of the building's one-time occupants has made them uneasy about their Muslim neighbors.
It's probably changed forever.
Esther, as we'll call her, didn't want her real name used out of concern her comments might offend. Even though she says she tries to see people as individuals, she says today, 10 years after the September 11th attacks, she still finds it challenging to put her anxieties aside.
I think you're leery. I actually had two women work with me who wore their Muslim garb to work every day. They would talk to each other in their own language, and in the back of your mind, you're always thinking, what are they talking about? You know, you just wonder, because not everybody in this world is good.
Just blocks away from Esther's once-white and Catholic neighborhood is the Islamic Center of San Diego. This is the mosque where Rawya Amalt, a devout Muslim, comes to pray.
Don't judge us by the way we look.
Amalt has worn a headscarf since she came to this country from Egypt 30 years ago. Before September 11th, she felt she was accepted in the community. But since then, she's been the target of harsh stares and even harassment.
It felt uncomfortable walking around with a scarf.
And even one time, I think my husband was at the bank at the teller machine outside, and somebody told him, go back home, which really bothered me because to us, this is home.
This is also the mosque where the two hijackers who flew the American Airlines plane into the Pentagon came to pray. Ever since then, the mosque has been viewed by some with suspicion, a perception that Imam Hassan Taha says he's trying to change.
The community here doesn't feel the guilt of what happened in 9/11 because it has nothing to do with that. We don't have control on people. We don't ask people who come to the mosque, what's your intention? We don't even ask them what's your faith.
Taha says that for the past 10 years, he and other Muslims have had to be on the defensive every time there's a terrorist attack overseas.
They always think we are responsible on what happened over there. So every time we have to go out to the media, condemn, and tell them that, listen, we have nothing to do with that. Our faith has nothing to do with that.
Taha remains troubled by published reports 3 years ago that the Islamic Center of San Diego was under FBI surveillance. He says many Muslims believe they are unfairly subject to heightened government scrutiny just because of their faith.
That is incorrect.
Daryl Foxworth is a spokesman for the San Diego FBI office.
The FBI does not focus its surveillances on places of worship. If we're conducting a surveillance, our surveillance is focused on an individual or the individuals that may be involved in criminal activity or potential violations of national security.
Last year, the feds arrested the imam of another San Diego mosque and four other Somalis for alleged ties to the Somali terrorist group Al-Shabaab. But Foxworth says the Bureau continues to reach out to the Muslim community, holding meetings with community leaders, explaining security concerns, and encouraging cooperation. He says the meetings have been cordial.
Found it also to be at times challenging, but what we have to keep in mind is that we have to continue to partner together, to work together in order to make all of us safer here.
Taha welcomes the dialogue. He is also building relationships with people of other religions. He meets regularly with Christian and Jewish leaders to discuss faith issues. This is a crucial way, he believes, fear and suspicion will be overcome.
Before 9/11, the Muslim community did a very poor job in terms of building bridges of understanding and respect between them and the larger society. After 9/11, we found ourselves in a position where it's not optional anymore.
Imam Taha and others from his congregation will commemorate the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks at an interfaith prayer service Sunday. For the California Report, I'm Amita Sharma in San Diego.
This week, Nonesuch Records released a musical reflection on the 2001 attacks. WTC 9/11 is written by Pulitzer Prize-winning composer Steve Reich. The piece was commissioned by the San Francisco-based Kronos Quartet. They approached Reich in late 2009, asking him to compose a piece using recorded voices, not thinking about the 9/11 anniversary. Reich, who lives in New York City, says the notion of tying the composition to the attacks came to him suddenly.
God knows, it just, like a light bulb in the cartoon, it popped in my head, wait a minute, I have unfinished business. 9/11, this huge thing that happened in my life, which is, an ongoing reality for all of us, was something that I should address. And now I've been asked to address something. This is it. And as soon as the light bulb went on, I immediately went to the public domain archives of the traffic controllers, NORAD, and the fire department in New York. And then I decided that after I did that, I would speak to my friends and neighbors, having them reflect back 9 years later on what happened to them that day.
Given that 9/11 still evokes raw emotion in so many people, I asked Kronos Quartet founder and violinist David Harrington if he had any concerns, musically or otherwise, when Steve Reich decided to compose a reflection on the terror attacks.
Yes, I had concerns, Whose voices were those? Whose relatives might hear those voices again? I mean, but I also knew that in the hands of Steve Reich, there was going to be a major piece, and that in terms of the human aspect, I was very confident that it would be treated not only with care, but in a beautiful way.
Talk about the role of the music in WTC 9/11, because the piece begins with and ends with the lead violin echoing that loud warning beep, sort of like the sound of a phone off the hook. You're pointing to your arm.
I'm pointing to my arm because
the hair is raising.
The hair is raising because basically my part starts the piece, and my part is interlocked with the phone off the hook, and it's a hair-raising sound.
Well, what does it evoke for you? It's sort of a warning, danger, discomfort.
Exactly, and it's this kind of insistent, you know, something is wrong, you need to deal with something.
Did you see the role of the string quartet as to amplify the voices, to provide continuity between the voice or the warning signals? I mean, what did you see the role of the music being in this piece, with, you know, given that it's really built around the voices?
Steve has explored vocal melodies for years. In fact, if he were here right now, he would probably be hearing the melodies of our conversation. That's how he hears melody. And especially if he's doing a piece that involves kind of a documentary sort of approach to things, he creates the melodies from the speech rhythms and melodic patterns. And so, I mean, we knew that our role would be to make these melodies into instrumental music.
Everyone is running and screaming. Then the second plane hit. The second plane hit.
It was not an accident.
It's interesting. There's a lot of things that are very difficult and sometimes even impossible to notate in music. And some of those things occur in the final movement of Steve's piece. The rhythms, what he wrote and what we play aren't the same, and he'd be the first one to tell you that you can't notate certain aspects of rhythm. You have to listen and then play, and that's what we did.
And that final movement is WTC, which, as he has pointed out, is World Trade Center, but also World to Come. Stands for World to Come, looking forward, and the voices of some of the women who were doing prayer over the bodies after 9/11. What emotions does that evoke in all of you as you play it?
Well, we had the privilege of playing WTC 9/11 at Carnegie Hall last spring. And when I walked out on the stage, I knew, I could feel that there were people in that room that had lost loved ones. I felt that what Steve had created and what we were able to provide that night would take the audience through the entire experience. And that the final movement, I think, is a miraculous musical accomplishment, because it really does take the listener beyond. And the sound of the rabbi, the cantor singing, is absolutely incredible. The sound of the female singer is amazing. And the power of that tradition is indisputable. I mean, in a musical way, it really does take one to some other level that has been transposed.
What do you think people take away as they leave the concert hall? What do you want them to take away? What do you want them to be thinking about or feeling?
I think there's a very potent image. When I bring the phone back in the last, say, 30 seconds of WTC 911, it's almost like a warning. Like, really, that phone is still off the hook. And there's a lot to do to make this world right.
And there's the world, and there's the world right here.
Violinist David Harrington is the founder of Kronos Quartet. They commissioned Steve Reich's piece WTC 911. It's a musical reflection on the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Kronos Quartet will perform WTC 911 in concert at UC Berkeley's Hertz Hall October 9th. You can hear more of my conversation with David Harrington, including his thoughts on Steve Reich's decision to change the controversial album cover of WTC 911. It originally featured an airplane flying toward the burning World Trade Center. You'll find that, along with much more of my interview with Steve Reich, at californiareport.org. For most of us, the impact of 9/11 is felt by things like longer waits in airport security lines and more obtrusive body scans and pat-downs. But those relatively minor inconveniences pale compared with the sacrifice and disruption felt by thousands of military families in California. Central Valley Bureau Chief Sasha Coca has the story of one woman with a 20-year Army career whose deployment after 9/11 transformed her family's life.
It's a maintenance test flight, so they're checking all the repairs that they've done.
Master Sergeant Blanca Gonzalez Pryor spent the last two decades working in a huge aircraft hangar here at the Stockton Army Aviation Support Facility. Giant helicopters shaped like dragonflies dwarf the mechanics working to change the rotor blades.
Right now, the blades are not going full speed, but when they crank up, oh my God. Been pelted in the face a couple of times, and so you just kind of duck and roll, and the wind just throws rocks like nothing.
Gonzalez Pryor is the one who makes sure these helicopters are stocked with supplies. It's a job that's gotten more intense as U.S. troops have deployed to Afghanistan and Iraq. Her co-workers have taped a picture of an evil witch above the storeroom cabinets because she keeps such an iron grip on the Post-its, wrenches, and grease guns. But when she gets home, takes off her fatigues, and shakes out her long, dark hair, the 43-year-old soldier transforms into a soft-hearted grandmother whose grandkids call her Mom.
Mom! Say hello, Mom!
How was school today?
Gonzalez Pryor is used to having a lot of kids around. She's the 12th of 14 children, born to parents from Mexico who played in mariachi bands. She enlisted in the military right after high school. She met her husband, also a soldier, and together they raised five children who grew accustomed to life in a career military family, one that didn't involve active combat. Then came 9/11. Gonzalez Pryor's daughter Gina was in the eighth grade.
Her and my dad, they came in, they woke us up. And we're staying in their bedroom, and then my mom's like, "You need to watch this." And I was like, "What's going on?" And I was reading everything that happened. And the only thing I could think of was my whole family's going to leave me.
And Gina was right. First, her mother spent long months loading helicopters late into the night. Then her father, Craig, was deployed in 2003. And the following year, Blanca Gonzalez Pryor was sent to Kuwait, Qatar, and Afghanistan. Her five teenagers were in middle and high school.
I'm a very hands-on parent. I don't know how to parent
from a distance. That was my challenge, and I want you to know that I failed miserably.
Without much guidance from their mom, the kids rebelled. Some got piercings, tattoos, or rainbow-colored mohawks. Her daughter Vanessa, then 17, got pregnant.
It's hard to incorporate being a rebellious teenager and, you know, thinking that you're an adult way before you actually are and, you know, all that. And then on top of, it's like fighting someone who's not even here, you know?
Vanessa gave birth to a daughter, Emma, in 2004. But Gonzalez Pryor says it was painful to keep regular contact with her family while she was deployed.
I can tell you I would just sometimes call home and want to talk to Craig and do nothing but cry. I can't talk to the kids because I don't want them to feel or sense what's happening to me. To them, they thought I was on vacation abroad. They didn't understand that it was a war zone, a place where, you know, not everything is peaches and cream.
Daughter Gina says nearly 6 years later, she still doesn't understand.
She said it was easier for her to not be able to talk to us because for whatever reason, it was just easier for her. And that, like, super sad because, you know, that's my mom.
In order for me to be efficient and stay alive, I had to, okay, guys, I love you, but, you know, you're just over there. Just stay there.
Finally, after 14 months, Gonzalez Pryor was able to come back. But the walls she put up with her family have taken a long time to erode. She says she got home, put on pajamas, and stayed in them for weeks, feeling alienated from everyone.
It took me a long time to really want to hold my kids. You know, I would hug them. In my head, I knew that's what I was supposed to do, not because I really felt it. So the emotional connection has been a long time coming.
With one exception, her granddaughter Emma was a year old by the time Gonzalez Pryor came home. Even though she'd been mortified when her teenage daughter got pregnant, her baby granddaughter was the one who helped coax her back to her old life.
She was totally the positive focus. You know, we just laugh and play and tickle. And I don't know if it's because she was new or because she had no expectations, but she was the only sanity at that time.
I know how. Foosball with babies.
Emma's now 6 years old, and she and her grandmother still make each other cackle with delight.
You dork.
You weirdo.
You're weirder.
Emma's got a 2-year-old sister and another baby sibling on the way. Their dad is now serving in Afghanistan. Blanca Gonzalez Pryor's daughter Vanessa says she's glad she's had practice learning to cope when someone she loves is deployed and how to survive their bumpy reentry into family life.
Do you want me to kiss and make it feel better?
For the California Report, I'm Sasha Coca in Stockton.
And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman. The senior online editor is Gabriel Cohen with help from David Marks. Our producer is Victoria Maleone. Pat Flynn was a contributing editor. Ingrid Becker is our senior producer. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. The California Endowment, building healthy communities because that's where health happens. More information at calendow.org. And the SunPower Corporation, offering high-efficiency solar energy solutions to households and businesses in California and worldwide. The world standard for solar. SunPowerSolar.com.